pro-choice liberal feminazi slut Rush Limbaugh warned you about. It's Start Me Up.
Start Me Up.
With Kimberly A. Johnson.
Greetings and salutations. It is the last day of November 2016, and that just means we're that much closer to President Donald Trump. Put in that barf sound. oh, God. So where do I... Ew! And you know how much I hate that sound. That is... that's pretty much how I feel. So this show is my bonus show for my three listeners. Woohoo! I can't remember your names, but whoever you are, I think, I do know a few of you, but I don't know if I'm going to pronounce your name correctly. So I'm just going to say thank you for being a subscriber. And Bob Seska and I are going to do our best to entertain you today. I don't know, you know, I'm not going to push subscribing because you already subscribed the most you can possibly put in there. So thank you. First, we're going to talk a little about some politics, and then we're going to go into some holiday banter because I'm looking for any and every excuse to forget what the future holds. And, you know, it's important, I think, that we get some of these things out of the way, at least for me, because, you know, I have a big mouth and I like to use it. So I'm just going to jump right in. And Bob, if just in case, I think you probably know who Bob is by now, but if you don't, he writes for Salon. Forever he wrote for the Huffington Post. He has his own podcast, very popular, The Bob and Chez Show, with his partner Chez Pazienza. And he's also on John Fugelsang every week, and he's on Stephanie Miller every week, and he's loved, and he's my boyfriend and my producer. So welcome, Bob.
Oh, I'm on. It's time for me to come on. Okay. For some reason, I thought we were doing two segments like the actual show. All right.
We're just going to wing it.
I was looking. I was desperately trying to find music to play for the transition between the two. But okay. All right.
Well, that's okay. Well, let's just start with, first of all, you know, you and I talk about things all the time. So let's rehash some things that we've discussed and... Let's start with this whole recount that the Green Party, Jill Stein, is that her effort to get a recount in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Mm. Some people are saying that she's being self-serving. Other people are saying that they don't want a recount. Some people love it. So, of course, I have my personal feelings. What do you think?
Well, obviously, I think it's a good thing, if for no other reason than to weed out those possibilities that the election was stolen. And I was just looking at Nate Silver's Twitter feed. Let's see if I can bring it up here again, because he released data on the difference between the polling and how Donald Trump actually fared in those particular states. Mm-hmm. In fact, all of his states, all the states that Donald Trump won. Interestingly enough, in Wisconsin, Donald Trump beat the polls by 6 points.
Hmm.
In Pennsylvania, he beat the polls by 4.8 points. In Michigan, he beat the poll by 4.2 points. I think that's how it works out. So, in other words, in Michigan, his average polls came out to be about... his polling average came to be about minus 4 points. Like, he was set, according to the polls, he was set to lose Michigan by 4 points. He actually ended up doing plus 0.2 over Hillary Clinton, wow, which shows a net total gain over the polls of 4.2. The most striking one, obviously, is Wisconsin, the most striking and surprising one. I'm looking here. It says the adjusted polling average in Wisconsin was Trump losing by 5.4 points. That's outside the margin of error.
Mm-hmm.
All right, he ended up winning Wisconsin by 0.7 points.
Jesus.
Less than 1 percentage point. And that means he beat the polls by 6.1 points. That's according to Nate Silver in 538. That's massive.
That just makes me want to curl up in a fetal position and stick my thumb in my mouth.
Yeah. So he only actually did worse than his polling in, let's see, I count one. He did worse than his polling in Colorado, did worse than his polling in Nevada, New Mexico, and that's it. Every other place, he actually beat his polling numbers in the final count, which means every pollster and every exit poll was wrong.
Yeah, there's just something. It just makes me so angry, this whole thing. And back to Jill Stein for a moment, at least the way I feel about it. I'm glad she's doing it. The Clinton campaign is in on it. And who gives a shit if she's doing it for herself? Of course she is. She's a politician.
Yeah.
And everybody, you know, I mean, I see people commenting out there on social media, and they, of course, they're going to take this all personally because it is personal. But to criticize Jill Stein for doing this, duh. Yeah. I think one of the only politicians out there, and I'm not saying he doesn't do it at all, but I think probably the most earnest and the one looking, the one who's least looking for the self gain was Bernie Sanders.
Yeah.
But pretty much, and you know, I'm not saying he doesn't do it at all. I do think he really wants to fight for the people. I really do. Mm-hmm. I thought Hillary Clinton did, but of course she does. She's a politician. She was in it for herself just as much as any other politician out there.
Yep.
So to criticize a politician to be in it for themselves is just stupid and a waste of time.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's silly to believe that everybody has fully altruistic motives. Like everyone's out to benefit other people and no one's out to benefit themselves. I mean, it would be ridiculous to even claim that on any level whatsoever at any job, for God's sake. We're doing this to inform and entertain right now, but we're also doing it to make a living.
Yeah.
And you know, that's a major, major part of it. Without the make a living part, why do it? Without the audience part, why do it? I mean, it'd be kind of silly if we just did this without anybody listening.
Right. And, you know, as far as Jill Stein is concerned, I don't like her. She's not my favorite, you know, candidate, whatever you want to call her. I don't like her.
Yeah.
But I don't hate her. I'm not going to vote for her. I doubt that she'll ever give me a reason to vote for her. But one thing that I will say is if she, you know, I think her goal here is to elevate her name, brand, and her recognition so that the next time around she, you know, gets 5% of the vote and the Green Party gets more money. I have no problem with this because the Green Party is going to push the Democrats, and that's good. I want the Democrats to feel the pressure because it doesn't seem like they've been feeling it from regular people so much. So I think that, you know, a third party that could come along and push them, I think that's great. And that's pretty much what I have to say about that. I'm hoping for a Christmas miracle.
Yeah.
I don't really think we're going to see the results that we all would like to see, but I think overall it's a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, I saw something the other day that kind of compared this to, the birther thing from 8 years ago, but obviously this being more grounded, much more grounded in reality, but in terms of the overall effect on a Trump presidency, and I don't think the Electoral College is going to change anything.
No.
I think Donald Trump is going to be inaugurated on January 20th. I think that's absolutely going to happen, but it all depends how effectively he's going to be able to govern, considering that his popular vote or the popular vote margin for Hillary Clinton keeps rising and how his actual behavior during the transition gets worse and worse and worse, how he's going to be insulting, if not creating plenty of disillusionment among his supporters by elevating Goldman Sachs people and not draining the swamp, elevating people who have been doing the job, people like Elaine Chao, who's been doing this since 2000 when she was hired by George W. Bush to be deputy labor secretary, or actually be labor secretary. She was labor secretary throughout the 8 years of the Bush administration. Presided over, by the way, the Great Recession, in which the jobs were just hemorrhaging away, hundreds of thousands a month. These are all things that are going to contribute to Donald Trump's, at least in the traditional sense, Donald Trump's inability to actually govern. All of these things combined, it's going to make it really difficult for him to have any sort of justification for moving forward with political capital. I don't think he's got much political capital at all. You just simply don't if you lose the popular vote. It was like George W. Bush wasn't running around in 2000 and 2001 saying that he had some sort of mandate and that he has political cap or that he had political capital. Donald Trump certainly behaving that way, even though he's fared far worse than George W. Bush did in 2000. Donald Trump doesn't have any political capital. He doesn't have any sort of wind at his sails to be able to do some of the things that he wants. The only thing going for him right now is the Republican control of the Congress. And so in that regard, that but they're going to have their own agenda. He's going to have his own agenda. My concern, obviously, goes well beyond politics as usual. I think that's where a lot of people are concerned, because mainly Donald Trump, I think, is going to behave in lots of ways. I think the most heinous things he's going to do are things that he's going to do outside the boundaries of normal politics.
Mm-hmm. Well, that brings up the whole idea of the burning of the flag tweet that he put out yesterday. And some people are saying that, oh, it's just a distraction and we need to be focused on healthcare. Well, that's true. It's a form of a distraction, but it's basically a warning. He's warning us again. He's letting us know that we're not allowed to dissent because if we do, we might be stripped of our citizenship or we might go to jail. And although dictator Donald isn't going to be able to necessarily send us to jail, it is still very scary to me that he is. This is outside, I think, what you were talking about, like some of the I don't know, the crazy shit that's going to go down. I don't think all of a sudden we're going to, you know, flip over the Constitution and start arresting people for protest. But then again, you never know, because look what's happening.
Well, see, that's the thing, though. That's the thing. People aren't going to be arrested for protesting. They're not going to be arrested for saying things on Twitter or Facebook or on their blogs or in major publications, for that matter, or on cable news, what have you. People are going to be arrested for things that are unrelated to the reasons why Donald Trump doesn't like them. So he's not going to go and say, hey, you made fun of my hand, so I'm going to arrest you now. It's going to be tremendous. The prison sentence is going to be tremendous. It's going to be huge. None of that's going to happen. He's going to arrest people for mundane things. He's going to pick them up for some sort of tax glitch, or, you know, there are going to be charges that are going to be unrelated to why Donald Trump is pissed off at X, Y, or Z. So he's not going to go around necessarily trying to deport citizens because they tweeted something nasty about him or burned the flag or anything like that. He's going to pick them up for something that's more mundane that he can, that certainly the legal system can sink their teeth into a little bit.
Yeah.
And make it not so obvious so that people can go along their day-to-day business not thinking that Donald Trump is the dictator that he is. And so that's how it's going to happen. And I don't think people understand that. I think people are expecting, they're hearing about Donald Trump and his neo-Nazi supporters online and all of the support that he has on Fox News Channel and AM Talk Radio and so on. And they think that it's all going to be obvious. Like, suddenly Donald Trump is going to be wearing a red swastika armband and goose stepping down Pennsylvania Avenue on Inauguration Day. That's not going to happen. It's all going to happen quietly and sort of underground, where suddenly journalists will start being picked up for weird things. Protesters, dissenters, dissidents will be picked up for odd charges. We won't know. They'll be scattered maybe in local newspapers here or there. And that's the real danger when and it's actually the most clever way to engage in despotism is to do it quietly.
Mm-hmm.
And he
sure gets help from his friend Joe Scarborough.
Yes.
Who there was an article that I posted on my Facebook page that he is basically telling people of color to calm down because they don't have to worry because, you know, all the crap that Donald Trump's saying is never going to fly in courts. And, you know, I'm so fucking pissed at him. I hate Joe Scarborough. He's this white privileged asshole who was in communication with he always kept telling Hillary to smile. I just want to slap his face. And anyway, I'm going off onto a tangent. He fucking pisses me off. And so if you happen to, if you're one of my three listeners who's on Twitter, please join me in telling him off, because he's just such an asshole. I mean, it's not that I think he's necessarily going to be reading my tweets or anything, but if people, you know, I just watched this fascinating interview with Bernie Sanders on Conan O'Brien last night. And Bernie was just driving in how we, the people, have to hold the media accountable. And so we do. We have to tell them when they're either normalizing Trump or, you know, not paying attention to the things that we need. You know, he brought up the idea. He's like, you turn on CNN, you turn on any of the major news networks, and they're focusing on a story that's, you know, a human interest or for instance, he was driving somewhere. I think it was maybe in the primaries, and I don't remember when, But he was pulled over. I guess he had a driver, but he was pulled over and they got a ticket. And the story became all about the ticket and not about the bigger picture, which was, of course, I don't even think they got into it in this conversation on Conan. But still, Bernie's point was we get lost in the little details of things, and we're not talking about climate change. We're not talking about the income inequality. We're not talking about the 43 million or whatever the number of people who are out of work. So it's true. You know, you have someone like Joe Scarborough who was telling basically all people of color to calm the fuck down. Mr. Rich White Man, who gets to sit at MSNBC News and talk with Donald Trump. Oh, don't worry about it. It's like, ugh. This makes me so fucking angry.
Yeah. Scarborough is one of these characters who emphasizes how unliberal MSNBC is. I mean, don't forget, Joe Scarborough is on the air for 4 hours a day, every weekday. Joe Scarborough is best friends with the executives at MSNBC, to the point where I think in a lot of ways Joe Scarborough calls a lot of the substantive shots, the content shots on MSNBC, and maintains MSNBC as something that outside of MSNBC people don't really understand, which is that MSNBC for about, I would say, 3 hours a day is fully liberal. That's Rachel Maddow. That's Chris Hayes. That's Lawrence O'Donnell. Outside of that, and then of course there are occasional shows like Joy Reid, but she's got a weekend show. Mm-hmm. On a daily basis, we don't see a whole lot of liberalism compared to either straight news or Joe Scarborough's 4 hours. So Joe Scarborough's got 4 hours in which he has rounds of
Chris Matthews.
Yeah, well, Chris Matthews, I think, is just while he's center left, Chris Matthews is more about just defending traditional politics. Yeah. That's what he does, basically.
Which is fine, but it doesn't necessarily hold anymore. In some cases, yes, it does, but it's changing.
Yeah. I mean, Chris Matthews basically spends an hour a day masturbating over photographs of JFK. That's what Chris Matthews does.
With his fancy microphone.
With his fancy microphone. That's right. His little headset microphone. But, you know, it's a network that has a reputation of being a liberal network, even though it's very much not. I mean, it's for a short period of time a day, you know, 3 out of 24 hours a day, it's liberal. I wouldn't call that a completely biased network. But regardless, a lot of that comes from Joe Scarborough and what he said about downplaying the impact of Donald Trump, which what Donald Trump is saying on Twitter, which, curiously enough, I mean, I don't necessarily agree with Bernie Sanders that what Donald Trump says on Twitter and the threats that he's making are irrelevant and a distraction.
No, that's not what he said.
He didn't say that?
No, he just said that the media will glom on to the insignificant details because it's either incendiary or or it's just that, like, for instance, they focused on the fact that he got a speeding ticket. And that became the whole, it was in the New York Times. And instead of whatever, you know, Bernie was, say, going to a rally and he was going to be talking about all the big issues and the article became about his ticket. That was his point.
Oh, well, that makes sense for him to be pissed about that. I mean, there's no reason for that to be an issue whatsoever. I do think what Donald Trump says, and this may not be specifically what Bernie was getting at, but I've seen this a lot on Twitter. I've seen this a lot on social media, that focusing on Donald Trump's tweets is a distraction. Like, Donald Trump somehow is playing...
No, I agree. We should totally focus on them.
Yeah, that he's somehow playing seven-layer chess or whatever it is, and he's got some grand strategy to distract people with craziness on Twitter while he does all sorts of nefarious things behind the scenes. I think you've got to take everything as one big unit.
I agree.
You can't ignore Donald Trump's obvious projection of despotism. He's actually his tweets are basically the canaries in the coal mine. His tweets are giving us an indication in terms of how he's going to govern, how he's going to represent himself on the world stage. And so we absolutely have to keep those tweets and his public statements.
And actually, Bernie specifically brought up that burning flag one. Yeah. And he made the point that, you know, or I should say I made his point, which I already felt anyway, which is that this is what, you know, he's sending us a warning. It's just like when he was the day after the inauguration, when he was talking about the protesters and he was suggesting they were paid. This is stuff that we all do have to take seriously, because, as you said, it's not like he's going to be wearing swastika bands around his arm, but these little tiny things all add up. and they are extremely important. And we do have to pay attention not just to the bigger picture of who he's appointing in his cabinet and where his politics are going, but these little things that he says on Twitter, because you're absolutely right. They are extremely important.
Yeah, definitely. And what Joe Scarborough said the other morning, and have this queued up right here.
You dick!
What Joe Scarborough said the other morning about this tweet was just so naive. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was talking about, it's like his basic point was, don't run around with your hair on fire. Don't run around like the boy who cried wolf. Weird use of language when it comes to speaking to people of color, by the way.
Yeah.
Don't do all of these things because James Madison and Alexander Hamilton built in checks and balances into the Constitution of the American system. What they didn't build in, it's just so stupid of Joe Scarborough to say this. What they didn't build in is they didn't build in stopgaps and fail safes for when an executive goes nuts and starts to violate the Constitution. What they did, Alexander Hamilton, in a lot of ways, being a loyalist to George Washington and in many ways an advisor to George Washington, Alexander Hamilton wanted George Washington to be the first president so George Washington could establish traditions of the executive branch. A way to carry yourself as chief executive of the United States, commander in chief of the military, and as chief diplomat of the United States of America. And in that regard, George Washington, I almost said Donald Trump. God damn it. In that regard, George Washington rose to the occasion and established these things. But they're all things that are a matter of behavior. There's no written rule that says, okay, here's how a president has to leave office once he or she has been impeached. There's nothing like that in the Constitution. So we rely on tradition. We rely on the American process, and we rely on the goodwill of our leadership to say that, well, if Donald Trump, if something terrible happens and there's some big high crime or misdemeanor that we can confirm and there's been an investigation and the House of Representatives say, okay, we're voting to impeach, and then there's going to be a trial in the Senate, and then it goes to the Senate and the Senate convicts him. What does Donald Trump leave the White? Does he just walk away? I mean, what indication has he given us that he would just walk away from the presidency just because Congress said he has to and because it's in the Constitution? There's nothing. Right. He's got 60 million Americans backing him up right now, saying that he can do no wrong.
Well,
he's going to have the will of the people behind him.
Yeah.
Well, at least the will of his voters. He's going to have all of conservative media backing him, internet people who aren't going to be convinced no matter what you say, no matter what evidence comes up against him, and no matter who stands up against him to impeach him. He's just going to stand in defiance of all of that. There is no check and balance to keep Donald Trump from doing whatever the hell he wants.
Well, and then there's also the idea that Joe Scarborough is missing that aside from what Donald Trump is going to have to face in, you know, with constitutional law, there's just ordinary citizens out there who are emboldened neo-Nazi white supremacists who are terrorizing regular other, you know, ordinary citizens of our community, people of color. Yeah. Joe Scarborough doesn't, I don't begrudge him of his wealth or his status. We disagree politically. That's all fine and good. I don't have a problem with any of it. What I have a problem with is he is a wealthy white man who is living in his white privileged bubble. And it's like when he's, you know, privilege splaining, or he's, I don't know what the splaining term is, but it's just like mansplaining. But he's doing it to people of color. He's telling people of color that they shouldn't worry, when those are the very people who are targets of the fucking lunatics out there who are bullying, you know, that guy on the plane and that lunatic chick in the Pete's Coffee who was screaming. And, you know, we're seeing just more and more incidents of violence coming up. Mm-hmm. That's what is threatening to, you know, like in a very direct, immediate way to ordinary citizens. Yeah. And Joe doesn't get it. And he doesn't fucking get to say to anybody what they can and can be, what they can't be afraid of. It makes me so mad I can't even think straight.
Yeah,
oh,
I mean,
God.
Everyone talks about how the left is so smug and how everyone on the left just thinks they're the greatest things in sliced bread, and we all go around with our ideas as if we're always right and that everyone else is stupid. You know who's the biggest violator of that? Not anyone on the left. It's Joe Scarborough.
Yeah.
I mean, watch any episode of Morning Joe. And I'm saying this as someone who has had pretty friendly conversations with Joe Scarborough. I mean, I've had pretty solid email conversations with Joe, and I, off the air, he's a different guy. He's much more humble. He's much more agreeable, easier to get along with, much more reasonable. He gets on a show sometimes, and maybe this is part of the damage that goes along with doing a show 5 days a week for 4 hours a day, formerly 3 hours a day. You probably get lost in your own world sometimes, and certainly he does, and he's got to carry 4 hours, or at least help to carry 4 hours, and that's a big responsibility. So, I mean, I think of the process, and we've all done this, where, and I'm not intentionally giving him the benefit of the doubt. I'm just trying to maybe find out why he went down this road, just utterly downplaying the threat of Donald Trump, and it could just be something he blurted, though I think it's much more calculated than that, because certainly he's been informally advising Donald Trump on the media for quite some time now, and still hasn't fully disclosed the extent of that advisory capacity, and I'd really like to know.
And I just think he's an ass face, and he needs to stop telling women to smile, and he needs to stop telling people of color not to worry.
That's right.
And I'm not giving him any benefit of the fucking doubt. I swear to God, if he was in front of me, I would just like unleash on him. But okay, so let's stop talking about ass-face Joe Scarborough. Now, I'm sure I'll never be on that show, so I guess he's not listening to my bonus show.
You know, I just wanted to add this one thing. I mean, there are a lot of things that are going to be going on, and this is not necessarily about Joe Scarborough, but there are going to be a lot of things going on with the Trump administration moving forward, and for that matter, the congressional Republicans. A lot of things said on Twitter, a lot of things said in the media, a lot of actions done to pursue different policy goals. Things that we're going to be tracking on a day-to-day basis, and it's important to keep track of, I know it's very, very difficult to do this, but it's important to keep track of all of it. For those of us who are political junkies, I think it's important to focus on everything, but to do so in a way that's taking a look at the big picture. Combine all of these actions and statements and policy goals together into a single tent and kind of look at it from 30,000 feet and say and see where it's going. That's the key. I mean, that was the key, I think, to tracking the George W. Bush administration, not looking at his individual stupid remarks and the thing with the door in China or the thing about sovereignty or the thing about won't get fooled again and all that crap. It's easy to get lost in the little bits and pieces. It's important to pay attention to those things, but pay attention to those things in a big picture kind of way.
Yeah.
So I think that is probably the best way to maintain your sanity. And I'm not talking to you, Kimberly. I'm talking to people listening in, to maintain your sanity as we go through what's going
to
be basically.
You'll need to help me maintain my sanity.
4 years. 4 years of this is a lot.
Yeah.
It's a lot. But I do think it is manageable to a certain extent. And I do recommend to people that they have some sort of physical outlet for their angst and outrage. And I strongly
encourage. Like a Joe Scarborough punching bag?
Like a Joe Scarborough punching bag.
Or which, Donald Trump.
Yeah, just use your Twitter feed and your Facebook pages to do those sorts of things and to make Scarborough and others your punching bag. Because otherwise you're just going to go, I mean, really, you're going to go insane. I mean, I started blogging on a regular basis in late 2000, it was right after the 2004 election. And I assure you, the second 4 years of the George W. Bush administration were easier to deal with than the first 4 years because I had a way to sort of blurt all that crap out and get it out of my head and onto a place where, you know, it might be read and it might be heard rather than me just screaming at my TV and having a nervous breakdown every time I turn on cable news.
Yeah.
So that's that. That's what I wanted to add.
So now I think it's a good time, since my blood is boiling, to switch gears and talk about much lighter things like Christmas and holidays and stuff.
Yes.
So let's do that.
And as you know, I don't like Christmas at all.
I know that.
just not a fan.
And that's one of my favorite Christmas songs.
Yeah.
This is one of my favorite Christmas CDs. I love it. And I remember I was at dinner with my dad's friends one night, and they played this, and we all had dinner. And I just thought, this is so cool. I mean, of course I watched the cartoon, the Charlie Brown cartoon, and that's what I thought of. But when we were having dinner, I just thought, this is classy. And yeah, it's like cool and adult, but it's also fun. So this one's definitely my favorite. This whole CD.
Yeah, and weirdly enough, the Linus and Lucy track, which is what we're listening to now, wasn't just specific to a Charlie Brown Christmas. It was specific. It was actually in all of the early, like the late 60s Charlie Brown specials, the cartoons. This was in the Great Pumpkin and whatever. I guess they did. Did they ever do an Easter one?
I don't think so. But they did Halloween.
Yeah, they did Halloween, and they did Christmas, and then they did a couple of random ones like they did a Thanksgiving one.
Yeah.
The Thanksgiving one was one of my favorites because a peppermint patty just acting like a dick.
Yeah, I know. But you know why I didn't like that one? Because I didn't like their horrid Thanksgiving. Was it Christmas? No, it was their Christmas dinner. I don't like their Christmas dinner. Jelly beans and shit.
Oh, no. That was their Thanksgiving
dinner. It was Thanksgiving. Okay.
Oh, my God. Yeah, yeah. And then that's when peppermint patty acts like a complete asshole. I mean, it's so fucking...
Sir.
Yeah, I mean it's so hilarious watching Peppermint Patty just go completely off. I mean, you got to hear this. I'm going to turn off the music here for a second because I want to play this particular, because I do have this lined up to actually play it on the show. Just Peppermint Patty going off on Charlie Brown's Thanksgiving. You know, it's like they tried their best. They're just little kids. They're all like the Charlie Brown kids are all like 6 years old or something
and
like that.
And she's just a fucking bitch.
And she's a total bitch about the spread that they lay out. And just where and
that's
it's not
how
just
I would
like,
be. I'm like, what is this shit?
It's not just like this is just all stupid looking. She doesn't just say that. What is this? She just goes off and just and doesn't ever stop. Listen to this.
Okay.
What's this? A piece of toast? A pretzel stick? Popcorn? What blockhead cooked all this? What kind of a Thanksgiving dinner is this? Yeah. Where's the turkey, Chuck? Don't you know anything about Thanksgiving dinners? Where's the mashed potatoes? Where's the cranberry sauce? Where's the pumpkin pie? Look at this. Is this what you call a Thanksgiving Day dinner? Did we come across town for this?
It's like your commenters on Facebook.
We're supposed to be served a real Thanksgiving dinner.
Don't feel bad, Chuck.
Says like for 30, she goes off for 33 seconds
but
about
I agree
how
with her.
Horrendous like,
what the freaking toast?
Yeah, toast.
Who wants toast on Thanksgiving?
But they're children.
I
what
know.
Do you expect them to deep fry a turkey?
Wah,
I mean, they're
they're
like four. I mean, it's amazing that they were actually even able to set up the table. By the way, have you ever seen the seating arrangement in the Thanksgiving episode of Charlie Brown? The seating arrangement at Thanksgiving dinner is. what's the word? Racist. Because what's the token black character in the Charlie Brown universe is sitting all by himself.
There's
all by himself on the one side of the table. And then all the white characters are all lined up in a big group on the other side of the table.
I never noticed that.
It's both hilarious and disturbing.
Wow.
That this was, I mean, it was very much a product of the 1960s,
right.
I think. Wow. They've got the Thanksgiving dinners segregated in the Charlie Brown universe.
Well, okay, so now that we've completely bagged on Charlie Brown Thanksgiving, what's your favorite like children's Christmas show, whether it's Charlie Brown or that you know, the claymation Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer? So
oh, well, that
Santa
that'd
Claus
be,
is coming to town.
That'd be it. I mean, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer is again, it's like a seating arrangement in the Thanksgiving episode of Charlie Brown. It's both hilarious and disturbing
all at once.
I mean, it's so trippy.
I haven't seen it in a long time.
I love watching that. I mean, just not only for the weirdness of the story and just the awfulness of the story, how terrible these characters are to Rudolph. I mean, just unrelenting about how he's different and how he's not allowed to participate in anything. And Donner, who's like the gym teacher. Yeah, I'm surprised they didn't all just like give him wet willies and pull down his gym pants or whatever. You know, they're just acting like assholes to Rudolph. But there's also... What I like looking at, as someone who's done some animation in my day, I like looking at all the mistakes in the animation, yeah. which is fun to look at. Like, for example, after a while, the little characters, the little puppets that they animate in that special start to get really grungy and filthy.
Like, I never noticed.
By about Act 3 in the story, Santa Claus's hands look like he's had them up his own ass for some reason. They're just, Santa Claus's hands are filthy. And I just want to say, okay, guys, you're animating this. You might want to clean up the Santa Claus puppet a little bit.
Or make a few of them.
Yeah, yeah. And then, you know, on top of how everyone's an asshole to Rudolph in this, just because he's got a red nose, for God's sake, they're equally assholes to Hermie. And they're just like, Hermie just wants to be a dentist. And right. and the boss elf is like, Hermie, well, you want to be a dentist? What the fuck is wrong with you, asshole? Go off and be a dentist, prick.
No, I want to watch that again.
Yeah, it's so...
We have to watch that.
It's so trippy. Yeah.
I'm under the influence.
I recommend watching it deeply under the influence because it is so weird. And you know, it's... Ultimately, there are just tragic things that occur in this story. First of all, the Island of Misfit Toys.
Right.
It's like, you want to talk... It's like sending off, like people with disabilities off into their own island or something. Like, you go over there because you can't be with the rest of us. But I guess there, in the end, Rudolph decides to pick up all the misfit toys. But then there's also the fact that in order to defeat the Bumble Snow Monster, Hermie rips out all of his teeth. It's like so inhumane.
Wow.
Yeah, it's like, PETA would go nuts at the time. Like, oh my God, I can't believe you defeated the Bumble Snow Monster by ripping out all of his teeth.
Just crazy. Well, we have to watch that.
Yeah.
And then, okay, so now, what about Christmas movies? Because I have some that I want to name. What, like, just overall Christmas movies?
Well, you know, I have a couple of choices for that. Obviously, my favorite Christmas movie is one, not surprising, it's A Wonderful Life. Even though most of it doesn't occur on Christmas, though the final act does. Mm-hmm. For the first 39 years of my life, I was like, oh, it's a campy, fun thing to look at. It's kind of a fishbowl of late 40s culture and things like that. Just looking back at the times of the way people spoke and how society behaved. And, you know, it was a nice little fun thing to watch at Christmas time. But then I think the recession rolled around. And I think a lot of us started looking at It's a Wonderful Life in a completely different way.
Yeah.
And being able to relate to some of the characters as adults and having to go through a crisis like the recession was. And so I look at that movie in a whole new way now. And weirdly, the other Christmas movie I really like watching is Die Hard.
Interesting. That's an interesting Christmas choice.
Yeah, I mean it happens at Christmas time, and that's sort of, I mean, there's Christmas music in Die Hard, and it's not, I mean, Santa Claus isn't in it, and they, you know, they don't rip the teeth out of a Bumble Snow Monster in it, but they certainly. It certainly takes place. So I guess that would qualify. Just the fact that
well,
it's
what
set
about
at Christmas
time. What about Christmas Vacation?
That's good. You know what? It's I like that movie. It's Christmas Vacation is sort of like a Christmas Story insofar as I feel like I need a break from it for a while.
Exactly. Me too.
I can't deal with a Christmas Story, and I really took a good long break from that movie because they show it all the time at Christmas time.
Yeah, I can't anymore.
And I'm tired of the cliches and the lines and the catchphrases from it, and just how quaint and fun it is. It's a weird thing to say, but. I feel like I need a break from it. And I took a break and then watched it again. And I was like, it's still too soon.
Yeah.
I need to take another 10 years or something like that.
Yeah, that's pretty much how I feel. I mean, I absolutely loved A Christmas Story like the first 50 times I watched it. And then I'm like, okay, I can't watch it anymore. I don't know if I can even ever watch it again. But I think I'd say one of my favorite Christmas movies is The Family Stone. We watched that last year, which is... Sarah Jessica Parker and there's the Claire Danes. There's a whole bunch of people in it, and that's it's just family, and it's kind of a tearjerker, but at the same time, it's one of those tearjerkers that's like a happy tearjerker, and it's, you know, slice of life. I always loved that movie.
Yeah.
And of course, I feel the same way about A Christmas Vacation. It's always fun to watch that. And you know, I mean, I guess there's a bunch of them out there. I can't say that It's a Wonderful Life is one of my favorites. I get it. I get the idea that after the recession, there's a whole new meaning to it, especially with the Wall Street and everything. But that's another one that I've like seen so many times. I know one of my mom's favorite, which is It a Wonderful Life? Oh no, it's the other one with the Tiny Tim.
Oh, Christmas Carol. Yeah.
She loves Alistair somebody?
Oh yeah. 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 That version of it is really good. I also like the version with Patrick Stewart as Ebenezer Scrooge.
Yes, she does too.
Yeah.
Because you're both,
both Star Stewart Trek nerds. Yeah.
Yeah. But you know, I mean, I like Christmas movies that are, the other one I like, and it's just silly, as While You Are Sleeping. It's just sugary with, why do I always forget her name? Who's this? We just watched it.
While You're Sleeping, Sandra Bullock.
Sandra Bullock, thank you. I'm forgetting everybody's name now. Sandra Bullock, and then the Mugu Guy Pan guy.
Bill Pullman.
So the Mugu Guy Pan is a reference from Mr. Wrong. If you've never seen Mr. Wrong, that's a funny movie.
The other Bill Pullman movie.
Yeah. But I like While You Were Sleeping. Those are fun movies.
Yeah. Yeah. Bill Pullman is endlessly entertaining. I'll watch anything with Bill Pullman.
Yeah. I'll tell you my funny Bill Pullman story.
Okay.
He's weird. And I'm only going to say this because it's on my bonus show that like it's not public. Mm-hmm. So I was at a place called the Derby in Los Angeles. It's a bar, not the Brown Derby, but it's called the Derby. And if you've ever seen the movie Swingers, the Derby was the last bar that they were in. And you know, they were dancing and everything. Anyway, so this was one of my hangouts, and I was at the Derby all the time. So one night I went to the Derby actually by myself, and I was sitting at the bar and talking to this English guy. We were flirting or whatever. And I could see Bill Pullman, and he was standing way across the room, and he was totally, and I believe he was with his wife or some woman.
Yeah.
And he kept looking over at me, and I was commenting to this English guy that I was talking to. I'm like, you know, that's an actor. That's Bill Pullman. He keeps looking over here. So slowly Bill Pullman makes his way to standing right behind me. And then he put his, you know, I'm on the bar stool.
Yeah.
So there's no back to the bar stool. It's just a stool. Bill Pullman put his entire back on my back and started rubbing up and down.
Oh, gross.
And I was like, I didn't know how to react to that.
That's a really weird move.
That is really weird. And the English guy sitting next to me, the look on his face was like, what the fuck? And I, you know, we were both thinking, what is this? And I don't know what that was, but that's my Bill Pullman story. I mean, he did that. And he had a woman with him. She was standing right there.
Weirdly, he did the same thing to me. I can't believe that. Did he ask you if you wanted to go for coffee in Mugu Guy Pan?
That's a reference to Mr. Wrong.
Weird movie. God, but so good for Bill Pullman. Just to watch Bill Pullman do
freaking weird
shit.
Sense of humor.
Yeah.
He's just got the weirdest way of delivering lines. And you know, there was several scenes in that movie where, for instance, there was that one scene, I don't know if you remember, but he was reading his poems to Ellen DeGeneres.
Yeah.
And he was just freaking creepy
so
and weird.
So sincere and so earnest. Yeah. President Bill Pullman. Yeah.
President Bill Pullman. So what about this? How about some of, cause I've got a crazy, Christmas story. Do you have any crazy Christmas stories? Like weird things that happened on Christmas?
Oh God.
Family arguments or inappropriate things happening? Because I've got a really inappropriate one.
Yeah. Go ahead with yours. Cause I have to come up with one. I'm sure there are many. There are many to choose from.
I think your life was slightly less crazy than mine.
Oh, I don't know about that.
Well, there, you know, my mom's a single mom, and she had moved us out to Los Angeles when I was 9 in 1977. So, you know, we had Christmas one year where it was kind of like just stragglers coming in and either people who didn't have anywhere else to go or people who had dinner with their family and then came over to our house afterwards. So there was a big group of us, and I'm not going to say her name, but my best friend was there at the time, who was extremely inappropriate. She would say things for shock value. And this was actually before I realized that she was so highly inappropriate. And, you know, we were all sitting around the dinner table, and it was after dinner, and my mother was asking everybody, would anybody like some tea? And so somebody asked her, well, what kind of tea do you have? So my mom goes through the list and she's saying, well, I have, you know, Earl Grey, and I have, you know, whatever, this and that. And then she says, and then we have black currant tea. And my best friend went, what? Did I just hear you correctly? Black cunt tea? And she just kept, she just kept saying black cunt tea over and over and over. And everybody around the table was like, like you could just see in their face, like, I don't know what to do. And it was so inappropriate. And normally, as I do in these situations, I just laughed because I just didn't, you know, it's like you're so uncomfortable. But it was actually kind of clear to me that she was looking for that attention. But still, it was really that was one of the more inappropriate Christmases.
Yeah, I would say someone mistaking black currant tea for black cunt tea.
It was awful. And she said it like 20 times.
I don't think they sell that at Whole Foods.
I have another one if you're still searching.
Oh, okay. Yeah, go, please.
Okay, so I have these crazy cousins too, which I won't name. But now picture that it was early. I think I was maybe 7 or 8 or something like that. Mm. And so it was my mom and her Catholic mother and her brother who was a Jesuit brother. And then like our family with my three cousins who are... I'd say the oldest one is 10 years older than me. And then I think the next one down is maybe like, say, 15 years older than me. I mean, I'm sorry. I mean, 5 years older than me. Mm-hmm. And then the next one is like 3. So I was just like this little girl watching The Troublemaker 3. And I'll change the names here. Okay. So let's say my cousin Robert. It was my cousin Robert, my cousin Michael, and my cousin Deirdre, right? So Deirdre says, as my Jesuit brother uncle is saying grace, she was saying, Robert's got a girlfriend, Robert's got a girlfriend. So Robert literally, and I'm not kidding you, I swear to God this happened, stands up, pulls the leg off the turkey, and starts hitting hitting her on the head and saying, fuck you, Deirdre, you bitch, in front of everyone.
Oh, my God.
My mom loves telling that story. It's hard for me to tell it when I change the names because I want to just go automatically to the name. But my family's kind of crazy. And yeah. So
it's always
it
a bad
was fun.
It's always an eventful Christmas when someone gets beaten with poultry.
And fuck you in front of a Jesuit brother.
Yeah, good God. Yeah, oh, well. I think the weirdest Christmas I ever had was, because right out of college, I went right into radio. And when you start out in your first radio job, they make you take the worst shifts imaginable. And one of the shifts I had to take was Christmas Eve into Christmas morning. And it sucked because, you know, I couldn't go home for the holidays and I had to work and it was just miserable. And everyone, I just sat there on the air, just imagining everyone at home, you know, with their eggnog and all that happy crappy settling in for the evening and, you know, kids putting out the cookies and the milk and everything for Santa Claus. And there I am at the radio station having to play Christmas music for 6 goddamn hours all night long. And then go back to my studio apartment in the morning and get some sleep and then go back and do it again. And so I decided to do something that I didn't get permission for. I thought it was a great idea. Here I was, 24 years old, in radio for the first time, my first job, with all of that sort of mid-20s bravado. Like, now I'm in radio. Now I'm in the big I can do whatever the hell I want because I'm somehow entitled to do whatever I want for some reason. And so what I did, this was my brilliant idea. I decided to do a one-man radio performance of It's a Wonderful Life, where I had the script and I abridged the script so it would fit into a two-hour block. And and I rehearsed it and I did all the voices.
Oh my God.
And I had the sound effects and I had the music all set up. And I did regular commercial breaks. And then at this radio station I was working at out of college, you had to do newscasts at the top of the hour. So there was a break for a newscast in the middle of it. So I had to stop being, you know, Jimmy Stewart and, you know, and Clarence, the angel and all that shit in order to do the newscast at the top of the hour. It was so much credibility I earned in that.
And you didn't get fired?
Did you get in trouble? I almost did, because right after Christmas was over, I got called into the program director's office and was read the riot act, because, of course, everyone who works at the radio station's coming home from mass or whatever fucking church thing they go to, and they're turning on WEEU in Reading, Pennsylvania to hear the Christmas music as they finish their wrapping and set up for Santa Claus and all that crap. And instead they hear this 24-year-old radio newbie doing a shitty version of It's a Wonderful Life for 2 fucking hours. And it was not good. I was this close to being fired. I mean, the penance I had to do after that. I mean, yeah. I had to fill in on traffic, and they made me do just the shittiest stuff. Probably delayed getting a full-time job in radio by at least a year because of this stupid fucking idea. Though, you know, I do like to think that on some level, someone out there, someone had to have enjoyed it more as much as I did, because I had a blast doing it. It was just, in hindsight, it was the dumbest move I ever pulled in radio. But that was what, Christmas Eve into Christmas morning, I want to say 1994, maybe 1990. It was either 94 or 95. I don't imagine, because I started that radio station in June of 94. I can't imagine I had the latitude or the balls to be able to do something like that shortly thereafter. But I guess I may have. I mean, who knows? Just a stupid thing.
What makes you're so crazy for Christmas? You love Christmas. So what is it?
I think there's a bit of irony in it. I think I just like the change of scene. I like how everything suddenly looks differently for about a month. Everything looks unapologetically campy and fun and warm. It's just, I think there's just something that's fun and quirky and weird about it. Certainly, I certainly look at it with my eyes wide open. There was a great Ren and Stimpy cartoon back in the early 90s, in which they did something that was kind of a takeoff of Christmas, and it was Yak Shaving Day. And so they did this whole thing about the traditions of Yak Shaving Day. And one of the things was like, be sure to fill your grandpa's shoes with coleslaw. You know, and it was just like all these weird things. And we do all those weird things at Christmas time. Like, how weird is it that we hang stockings at the fireplace so that, spoiler warning, a fictitious character can crawl down our chimney?
Yeah, for all you 5-year-olds out there.
That's right. An invisible character crawls down, an obese man lands a sleigh on your roof, crawls down your chimney, puts shit into your stocking, and if you've been bad, he puts coal in there. And then we bring a pine tree into our houses and put decorations that we would never use throughout the rest of the year onto that. We festoon this pine tree with all this weird shit. But you know what? It's fun and it's warm and it's doesn't make you always happy. At least with me, I'm not running around, you know, sort of bleeding the Christmas spirit. But I when I do go and I look at the tree and I look at the decorations and I hear some of the music, and for a short period of time, once a year, makes you feel kind of good. Now, certainly a lot like, you know what it is? When it's over, I can't wait to take the crap down.
Yeah.
And it's almost like, this is a really weird, such a weird analogy. It's almost like trying to watch porn after you've had an orgasm. You know what I mean? It's just like, after Christmas and New Year's is over.
Yeah, I get really testy. You know, I'll give everybody until July 6th. I mean, I'm sorry, January 6th, because I'm not religious, but I know that that's like the official, whatever, July 6th. January 6th. My grandmother used to talk about that, who was Catholic. So, but when I see lights up on January 7th, I get so fucking pissed off. It's like, take it down now. It's over.
I know. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever after it's over. The minute that January 2nd rolls around,
I'm done. I'm done on the 1st. I like taking everything down on the 1st. I'm just done.
Yeah. It's just everything starts to look gross.
And I've always had this like you know, I don't have any children, so I didn't have the experience of the joy of having a child to relive my Christmas childhood.
Yeah.
So, you know, I certainly don't discount that for parents and for, you know, I think Christmas is the most fun when there's kids, when you can watch the kids and how excited they get to open things and they're so cute in their little nightgowns and all, you know, in their little pajamas.
Yeah.
I don't have a heart of stone, but at the same time, I did work in retail for many, many, many years, and that pretty much taught me to hate Christmas. I hated everything involved with everything retail, and I was so much like Bah Humbug Charlie Brown, and I started really recognizing that, and I'm not religious, so there that component is gone. I don't even experience that.
Yeah.
So, you know, what's left? All the greed, you know, find your Christmas spirit at Macy's. I just want to say, fuck you. I never want to go to Macy's when I see stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's not to say that I don't enjoy exchanging gifts, but I guess I've always kind of had this Bah Humbug attitude. Like, why are you forcing me to buy presents for people? Which if I'm going to buy a present, I'd rather just buy a present. Now I feel like people feel like they have to buy me one and I have to buy them one. And I don't like the idea of a forced gift giving thing.
Compulsory gift
giving. Yeah, I understand that it's important for the economy and all of that, but you know, I like the decorations.
Yeah.
And fortunately, because I'm not Miss Social, and I don't always run to all these social events, any extra food or whatever isn't, you know, an issue for me. You know, whether or not I gain weight has nothing to do with holiday parties, I should say.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, I think being with you now and having your perspective in my life and your joy of decorating and all of that, it helps to elevate my mood about Christmas, because I've usually seen it as something that just interrupts.
Yeah.
I'm on a roll, and you know, usually what happens, whether it's in retail or in sales, because I was also just an outside sales rep for a while, and I noticed, like, you know, you always slow down in the summer. And then it takes a little while to pick back up. You know, you're usually back in the thick of it around October. So you have October and November where everything's kind of moving swimmingly and you're doing great. And, you know, the same thing can be said for blogging. Of course, you can have up and down months no matter what time of year it is. But it seems just as soon as December hits, everyone goes into that mental break mood, whether you're working or not. People are, you know, bringing their Christmas trays in and they're talking about their Christmas plans and work starts to halt. And I'm like, wait a minute, I was just on this roll. I'm on a roll. Everybody has to just chill and, you know, keep rolling, and they don't. So I've seen it as an interruption. And, you know, I mean, it's not to say that I don't enjoy. And plus, there's also the idea that because my family, with the exception of my mother, all lived back east, and, you know, my mother and I lived in California, it was also something that I didn't get to go to family celebrations all the time. Usually the pattern was for us when I was younger, I would go to Maryland like on the 26th or the 27th, and I would spend after Christmas and New Year's with my dad. So I did get to see family, but it was just something that was kind of an interruption. Now, I haven't said this publicly on my Facebook page or whatever, but, you know, you and I are going to be eventually moving back east. Not exactly sure when, sometime next year or within a year.
Yeah.
We'll be moving back there. So now we'll get the extra added joy of having to deal with all the relatives who are butthurt because we can't, you know, we're going to this one's and not that one. So yay for that.
That's right. And I'm now recalling that my enthusiasm for Christmas really spiked when I moved to the middle of the Pacific Ocean and then later to California, far away from.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I know my father, I just spoke with my father this morning, and he was like, you know, I just can't wait until you're back for the holidays. And I thought, yeah, wait till I tell you that I can't go because we're going to Bob's mom's house.
Yeah, exactly. God, that's going to be really, really looking forward to that. But I think, you know, I think part of what rekindled my enthusiasm for it, because for a long time being in radio and having to work on Christmas, I started to ignore it and not give a shit about it. And then, you know, I raised a daughter, a stepdaughter for 15 years. And so, and then that started when she was age 3. So that, of course, was a big part of it because
it became fun.
Yeah, it became a big deal to just
because you live it through her eyes. You get to see it through her eyes and experience that vicarious, you know, feeling of Christmas again when you're young.
Yeah, exactly. And I do think, cynicism and irony aside, I do think there is, a revisiting of childlike innocence and memories from childhood and things like that. There's something that's illogical about all of it. And I think that kind of whimsy is valuable at the end of a long year. And you get to the point where you can take a little bit of time off from work. You can sort of breathe and you can kind of celebrate the fact that you've made it through another year. And I think that's kind of how, and you bring out all the same stuff that you do every year. And there's something that's comforting about that.
And you add to it.
Yeah, yeah. And so I think in those regards, I think it's really good. And then also, you know what? Weirdly, having a public platform and then incorporating Christmas into that public platform gives you a little bit something extra to play with. And this is really inside baseball, but doing three podcasts a week, it adds an extra flair to the show to incorporate Christmas music or to put in. I have fun little bumpers that I use, little Christmas jingles that I incorporate into the show. Just adds another dimension to it and one that's fun and whimsical.
Yeah, it's silly. So, exactly. Yeah, it's silly. An opportunity to be silly. It's an opportunity for adults, just like you said, to kind of take on that childlike quality.
Yeah, exactly.
And remember. Exactly. I don't know if you can hear, but Miranda, the kitty, is in here talking.
You got to join the conversation.
She's saying, Merry Christmas. Right?
Yeah.
Oh, well. Well, I guess that's going to do it. It's going to do it. I know you've got things to write.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
people to bitch at on Twitter.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I just want to say thank you to my listeners, to my subscribers. You guys are so awesome. I can't even believe that. You're so awesome. So, Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, Happy Holidays, whatever it is you celebrate. If you celebrate, if you don't celebrate, then, you know, Happy Wednesday. And I'll see you next year. Or, no, I'll see you next month. We're not there yet. I'll see you next month.
Bye-bye. Brown. He'll say, are you married? We'll say, no, man. You can do the job when you're in town. Later on, we'll conspire as we dream by the fire to face unafraid the plans that we made, walking in a winter wonderland. Parson Brown, he'll say, are you married? We'll say, no, man. You can do the job when you're in town. Later on, we'll conspire as we dream by the fire. Your face unafraid, the plans that we made. Walking in a winter wonderland. Walking in a winter wonderland. Walking in a winter wonderland. I said I'm walking in a winter wonderland.
It's Christmas. Baby, please come home.